Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 21, 2015, and welcome to episode 103 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. Hello, everybody. How are you?
Hey there, Michael.
Good. We're doing pretty well.
Oh, good. That's good. Excellent.
And I assume everybody out listening, you know, shouted, "We're fine."
Of course they did. Didn't you hear the tumultuous roar? Well, today we got Jack, Paul, Earl, and myself, Mike Mulhern. So, welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable. Okay, today's host topic. I was going through one of my recent acquisitions, and I popped open the CD drive in it, and in there was a CD. Nothing spectacular, but it was just interesting. But it brought back memories of more exciting things that I've found in machines that I've acquired over the past. You know, you get a machine, it's got a couple of interface cards that weren't listed in the eBay, and they didn't show good photos. Nothing spectacular there. Machines with extra RAM. You know, I've picked up a Mac 512 with a 1 meg of RAM in it, so that was a nice little find. But the most interesting one that I've had is that I was moving an AT while I was at one of my previous employments, and took it out, just needed to clean it down and make sure it was ready to use. This was had a channel adapter card for connecting to mainframe channels for a printer controller. And when I opened it up, I thought I saw something poking out from behind the power supply. So I pulled out the power supply, and lo and behold, I found a mummified mouse. Now, sort of got me a bit concerned about the power supply, but opened it up, checked it out, but no, the mouse hadn't shorted itself on the power supply. It had probably just crawled in there at some stage and decided this was a good place to expire. So, little interesting something that I found. I was just wondering if you guys ever found something a little bit extra when you picked up your retro computing machine. So, Earl, do you have any interesting extras that you've found?
Well, just a couple. One didn't have to do with retro computing, but it was pretty exciting. I'd actually picked up an estate sale, a storage locker full of ham radio gear and shortwaves and that. And as I was digging through the boxes, I found a complete HF transceiver, which is in this case, it was a ICOM, a multi-hundred-dollar transceiver. So that was a nice little bonus as I was pulling through. I'd paid a flat rate, and I'd calculated about what I thought the equipment would be worth. I wanted to make sure I was being fair. And it turned out that I got a couple of nice surprises out of that. But in the retro computing realm, I was at one of our community garage sales in the neighborhood that I used to live in, and I noticed a Commodore C64C sitting there in the box, and I inquired with the guy about it. I said, "Hey, what's this? I might be interested in buying this." He said, "Oh, I don't want anybody to buy it. I just brought it in case somebody wanted it. Are you interested in it?" And I told him, "Yeah, I'm interested in retro computers, Commodore in particular." He said, "Wow, that's great. I got more stuff." So in addition to the Commodore 64, he brought me the newer style 1541-2 disk drive. he brought a bunch of manuals and a bunch of discs and a couple of other accessories and a dust cover, and just basically loaded me up with a complete Commodore system. The only piece that he didn't have was the monitor that had gone to the Happy Hunting Ground sometime in the past. But he was very excited that he found someone who was enthused about it. He'd loved the Commodore back in the day, but wasn't interested in it anymore. So, yay, I really got quite the score that day.
So you didn't just get a free Commodore, you actually got you got all the extras to go with it as well.
I did.
That was excellent. Excellent. Now, I've never had anything quite as spectacular as that, but I've always seemed to find the problem ones. I had last couple of years, I suppose it's still recent, while I can still remember them, picked up a G5 Power Mac, which is almost heading towards retroness, but it was sold as non-working, but no clear pictures, so I took it home, and it basically looked like a dust bunny reservation. You could actually not see parts of the motherboard because of the amount of dust and everything that was in it. And that dust had all settled and stuck in place because the poor little computer seemed to have drunk a bottle of Coke. So,
oh no!
That was a fun one. It took me. I decided that bringing it home after work, because I just dropped by the person's place while heading home, I thought I'll leave this one until Saturday morning. And then Saturday morning, put the big tarp across the dining table, and my wife and I proceeded to pull the machine apart and clean it down. So just before, I suppose, 6 p.m., we had the machine all cleaned, reassembled, and turned it on, and it was perfect. It was a nice find. Just took us a good 8 hours of solid stripping and cleaning it down. But unfortunately, it had exactly in it what was specified, apart from the dust and the Coke. But yeah. So, Paul, in all of your little retro things that you've been picking up, have you found any special bonuses?
So I definitely have. Probably the most sort of interesting things that I found, and you know, they are generally things like software from 1980 and these sorts of things that I've wound up with have often been just in large lots. You know, so there were two sort of particularly good sets that I got, where it was basically just, you know, someone had been carting around the stuff from there. In one case, it was from a computer store in Anchorage, and he'd been sort of carting this around, you know, for however many years, and he finally just said, all right, you know, that's enough carting this around. And so he just put it all in a big lot, and you could sort of see what was in it, but they're, you know, hidden, you know, in the boxes and things, there were cassettes, and there were lots of, you know, like repair equipment. So I have a bunch of these little, like the little badges for the Apple II cases that have never been applied and that sort of thing, you know, so lots of kind of cool things that, you know, that just weren't worth listing. I've had pretty good luck actually with these, with big undifferentiated lots. They're often listed for a fair amount, you know, like a large amount, but ultimately sort of like what's in them tends to be good. I guess I can't really make a generalization or a recommendation for anyone else, but it's worked out fairly well. There are a couple of cases where I'm sort of proud of being able to spot things in blurry pictures. You know, I there's a particularly rare RGB monitor for the Apple II series, and it actually sort of it's one of the only color monitors that plugs in properly to the Apple III, and they have a sort of distinctive look if you look very closely, but otherwise they look a lot like a very common monitor. So I was very pleased to have noticed in the picture that this was actually that rare monitor, and even though there was no mention of it, it was, you know, that it was listed as something like old Apple stuff or whatever. I did manage to get in there without anybody noticing. But it is a lot of fun when you get something like that, and you saw in the listing there was a box, and when you open the box, it turns out it's got a whole bunch of these, you know, like very early arcade games you remember or whatever, things you know are very hard to, you know, like very expensive to buy now.
Mm. So. Now, it's always good to have a little bit of a surprise like that. So, Jack, I was wondering, what surprises can you tell us about?
Well, I don't really have any good surprises I can think of that I have found in equipment that I have picked up. But I one time, kind of through my own fault and kind of not, I left a surprise for someone else. And this is kind of along the lines of the misused computers you guys have found with a mouse hiding inside or a can of Coke spilled inside. So this was at a point in my life when I was just leaving one job and I had a laptop that belonged to this employer and I had about just a week or two left. I was going to be working there and something happened in my home where a person who I will not specify, I don't want to incriminate anybody, even though they may deserve it, spilled a whole glass of milk into my laptop. And this led to an immediate sort of incredible smell of like, it kind of smelled like cakes or something. And I immediately like, I unplugged the computer and I quickly ripped out the battery as fast as I could. But the damage was sort of done in a way. Like the computer wouldn't actually, like I couldn't open it up. It required a special Torx screwdriver that I didn't have. I couldn't open it up for 24 hours. Once I did, there was like, like I said, it smelled like cakes. There was literally a cake on the motherboard. The milk had just like completely solidified all over the motherboard in like what looked like a pancake. And I managed to find, I don't remember what I used. I used something to scrape off all this stuff and put it back together and turn it on, and it worked. Still kind of smelled like cakes, though. But I had to leave this, laptop back with my employer, my then former employer, and I didn't say anything to him. I just said, yeah, here you go. Here it is. You can let someone else use this now. And it may be that someone may have suffered with cake smell in their laptop for years after that. I don't know.
I was going to say, every time they turned it on, they remembered you. That must have been quite a bit of a challenging exercise, because I don't think you could have gone and Googled removing pancake baked onto motherboard of laptop computer.
It was totally hopeless. There were no such results. No, but actually I was pleasantly surprised that actually nothing was broken. That like, despite literally a full glass of milk being poured right into the keyboard, everything was actually fine. It was totally a surprise to me. So who knows?
Well, that's what I was surprised about with the Power Mac that I found. I was surprised that there had been no damages to the traces on the motherboard or anything caught in there to make connects over anything else, IC sockets, whatever. But
right. Well, especially Coke being rather... Coke is so corrosive compared to something like milk. You'd think that Coke would actually...
Well, you see all the things about now kids putting pennies into glasses of Coke to clean them, and there's quite a few whole other series of things that people say it can do, but it can't. But it's not exactly one of the most friendly substances that you can pour inside a computer.
Right.
Well, listeners, if you think you've found something even more interesting, drop us a line. Be great to find out what other people have found inside their retro computers. Okay, so we've got some listener feedback here. So, Earl, in a previous episode, you were talking about the possibility of getting a new run of floppy disks. I believe we have a listener who's got a more hands-on and quite an interesting idea.
Yes, Quinn of the Open Apple podcast wrote in with a suggestion on this. My idea had been, could we do a Kickstarter to put together whatever you would need for the manufacturing of new floppy disks? And I actually had no idea how simple or complex something like this would be. It was, you know, a complete brainstorm kind of thing. So Quinn's suggestion was that she had a more hands-on idea, researching making your own floppy disks at home. She mentions there are a lot of great resources out there on the process, and in truth, it's really very simple. Fundamentally, floppies are just a layer of iron oxide on a Mylar sheet, which that part I was actually familiar with. The challenge is the processing of getting the iron oxide onto the Mylar sheet and making them the exact right size, and how do you get them in the jacket. And she mentions the challenge is, in order for the end result to be reliable, high precision and a clean room environment are required. Now, those things I don't have. And to make a small version of that, I'm not sure what that would take. So she continues, the required precision and cleanliness might be out of reach for the home tinkerer, but I'm still looking into it. Believe it may be possible, and I will keep you posted. So thank you, Quinn. And I hope that it actually is possible. What would be even more fun than a Kickstarter where you could just go out and buy floppy disks is if the process was actually easy enough for somebody to do it at home. I think this would breathe new life into retro computing. I mean, maybe we'd get another decade or two out of our floppy drives. So I appreciate the email. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think it'd be good to have to only be worried about the keeping the disk heads of the drives clean and aligned if we could actually have new media as opposed to all of the new old stock that's around, or in many of our cases, recycling disks that we pick up secondhand. Okay, so we have another piece of listener feedback. Jack, do you want to tell us what Tony has sent our way for SID Tracker?
Yeah, so Tony sent a link to a thing called SID Tracker 64. This is an iPad app that lets you create tunes on your iPad that sound like they're being run on the Commodore 64 SID chip. It seems to actually contain some sort of SID simulator or emulator, because it can also open SID music files that are some sort of format that exists out there. And so you can open existing files and play them and create your own things in a tracker style environment. And the tracker music format is kind of this style of program sim that came about, I would say, roughly in the Amiga era. So the tracker programs didn't really exist on the 8-bit machines as far as I recall, but this program works in like a tracker sort of way, emulating the SID chip with its three channels of sound and all the waveforms and all this stuff. So you can make very authentic sounding chip tunes. And I'm not sure, but I would guess that since it can import these SID files, there's a good chance it can export them as well. And in that case, you can actually take your tunes you export and actually run them on a Commodore 64, I suppose. I don't see why not. Yeah, actually it does. I'm looking at the thing. It exports to the native SID Tracker 64 format, or the .SID for format for use in SID players. So yeah, pretty sweet. It costs $12.99 on the App Store, which is expensive for an iPad app in some ways, but seems like not expensive for what it is. It has an on-screen keyboard, or you can use an external MIDI keyboard as well, I believe, if you have things set up for that. So pretty darn cool. I like this sort of thing of being able to do chiptunes style things, and there are a variety of ways you can do this using completely modern software with plugins and things, but this seems like it's kind of, because it's targeting a specific thing, it's probably more attuned to what you want to do with the SID chip. So take a look.
Actually, no. It also reminds me, if I could jump in here, the I don't think we mentioned this because I think it may have happened since the last time we recorded. But there's a group, an Apple IIgs programming group called Ninja Force, that has just recently released something called Ninja Tracker, which is Apple IIgs based, tracker program as well. So if you tire of your using your iPad to do this, you can move over to your Apple IIgs.
Cool.
Okay, well, let's move into our items of interest, or what some of us like to think of as news. Okay, Earl, there's a new Kickstarter for the Amiga years?
Yes. I had mentioned in the last episode that it looked like the book from Brian Bagnell, Commodore the Amiga Years, was happening again. It had started and then kind of disappeared, and then it came back, and I was really happy to see it come back. I loved the original book, Commodore, A Company on the Edge. So the Amiga Years is now a Kickstarter, and it's going to be funded. It already, as of this point, has $30,000 of a $12,000 goal. So it's well funded. And I think Brian was mentioning in the comments that he might look for other stretch goals, and that you can add some of those even once a Kickstarter is actually in gear. So they've got some neat rewards on this Kickstarter, depending on what level you decide to fund it at. I'm very much looking forward to this book. I can't wait, actually, for this to come out. Looks like December 2015. And I haven't decided what level I'm going in at on the Kickstarter, but folks can take a look, and if you're interested in it, make your choice. And we'll have a link up in the show notes. And go, 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 Brian.
Yeah, that'd look good beside my Commodore 64 compendium, the visual compendium. It was on Kickstarter a little while ago.
Indeed.
That was actually... It was quite a nice one, so it's good to see that there's some new books allowing us to reminisce on our favorite old machines.
Well, so what will really be cool is when Atari Business's War comes out, because that's roughly the same time frame. That's the Atari ST, Jack Tramiel at Atari time frame, whereas the Amiga is kind of contemporaneous with that over at Commodore, and that was quite a battle. So I'm actually looking forward to read both of those books when they come out.
I was looking at the existing, you know, the existing levels, and one of the highest ones, I think it might be the highest one. If you pledge 400 or more, you can have dinner with a bunch of dinner with legends, with a bunch of the people who are sort of involved in it. In Commodore, I think, generally. So Bill Hurd, who it says, who will punch you in the face on special request. I don't know the story about it, but I assume that there is.
There is. They used to call him the Animal when he was at Commodore.
But, yeah, it promises, you know, not safe for work stories about the, you know, what happened in the in those years. Cool. But I think I probably will still not pledge for 400 for this, but I am interested in seeing it.
Well, talking about retro computers interesting us, here's one that's actually still warming our hearts. So, Jack, there's a Amiga 2000 that's still gainfully employed.
Yeah, so this is a little news from Michigan that popped up somewhere. Actually, no, where this popped up. This popped up on the Atari Museum Facebook group posted by Marty on there. The Grand Rapids Public School System, the heating and air conditioning for all of their various schools, like about a dozen schools around the area apparently, is all controlled by software running on an Amiga 2000. And so along with this, the article that we're going to link to about this, there's an interesting little video segment from a local news channel. The video segment is kind of interesting. Most of their slant on it is sort of like the reporters are asking, why are you still using this old thing? Like, you got some funding, some new bond money 4 years ago. Why didn't you replace this then? And they're like, well, there are other priorities, and this still works, which is actually pretty cool that it does still work. And it looks like this thing has some sort of connection to some kind of radio something, radio modem. I don't know what it is. Someone can maybe look at this and understand what the technology. They actually show us a brief glimpse of a piece of this hardware that apparently talks to hardware located at the various schools over the same radio frequency that's used by their walkie-talkies for their other stuff. And somehow it talks to these things, turns things on and off, and they show a glimpse of the software running on the Amiga. It looks like a very straightforward command line sort of thing. It's not using any special Amiga graphics or anything. Kind of makes me wonder why they need to continue to have an Amiga to do this, because it's probably just talking over a serial port to something, but there it is. And so they've been running this for 30 years, and whenever something breaks down, they got to go on eBay and buy parts. And in fact, one of the guys who talked in the video, he points at the computer and says, this came from eBay. So I guess that machine is not what it's running on originally. In fact, they keep saying it's been there for 30 years. So they must've started on an Amiga 1000, which must've been brand new at that time. And there's a proposal on tap to replace this system with a new system that will cost between $1.5 and $2 million, which sounds like a big expense to replace an old Amiga.
Well, with that kind of money, are they replacing it with an Apple One? You normally get for $1 million these days.
If that's the plan.
Is there not like an Amiga emulator that could run on a Raspberry Pi?
Good question.
One of the things that's interesting about this too is that it says, a Kentwood High School student programmed it when it was installed in the 1980s, and whenever the district has a problem with it, they go back to the original programmer who still lives in the area.
Yeah.
So that's it's quite a long lock-in.
Maybe the developer who's proposing the new system is actually just going to have an Amiga emulator running behind a Windows interface.
But he'll take the millions of dollars.
He will.
Right.
Well, that sounds like a bit of a retro challenge. So perhaps someone could take it up for the 2015/7 retro challenge, formerly known as the summer warm-up. So if anyone has a retro idea, programming, hardware, or anything retro-inspired, now's the time to join in a one-month-long competition over at wixonline.co.uk, a retro challenge. So have a look at the previous entries for the winter warm-up earlier this year. But it's a great way to get a little bit of inspiration and to get in and do a little bit of a retro project. So I'm not joining in this time round. I've decided that I'm going to be too busy this July. Not that I've been overly successful in the past, but gents, any of you planning to do a little bit of a retro challenge this year?
Nope, not me. Summertime, I know I won't get anything done.
Yeah, July is always rough because it's also, you know, half of it's taken up with Kansas Fest, and, you know, if I want to prepare for that. So every single time I think, oh, this time I'm going to do the retro challenge, and then, you know, and then there isn't time. But maybe still. There's still all of June. Still half of June. There's still a couple of days left in June to figure out what to do. I guess it's later in the year than I thought.
It is a bit, but yeah, I think I'll just try and inspire myself to go in the winter warm-up in 6 months' time. But no, between Kansas Fest and other things that are on, I just don't have the time to even attempt to fail in this one. But I'm sure we've got some listeners out there who will be gearing up to go in it again. So be good to hear from you if you're going to join in the summer challenge.
I will carry the torch for RCR. I'm entering. In fact, I'm already entered. I'm going to write a fourth interpreter for the Commodore 128.
Ooh, nice.
And by the end of July, it might do something. that's the total commitment you're going to get out of me, but I've already been trying to get my ducks in a row in terms of resources and reading up and that kind of thing. I won't actually, you know, sit down and start coding until the contest officially starts, but I'm trying to beef up what I need in my brain to be able to do it. So that's my deal.
Oh, that's all within the rules. You can prep as much as you like, but no fingers on keyboards until the 1st of July.
Right.
Oh, really? Yeah, I was wondering about that, because I might someday think about time-shifting it a little bit and, like, start mid-June so that I can be done by mid-July. But that's counter to the rules.
I'm sure that they might be able to give you an exemption on that. It does sound like that you're wanting to enter into the spirit of the game. But, Paul, while I've got you on the line, you've found some breakthroughs in OCR.
Oh yeah, so this is really just like a little video that I saw a link to. It's called The Computer Tutor, or How to Teach Your Computer to Read, and it's from I think it's from 1966, and it's talking about the development in OCR technology from Dallas-based Bill Stokes Associates. Oh no, actually that's not the company that made the machine is Recognition Equipment Incorporated, but the video is actually quite interesting. It's I think it's like 18 minutes long or something. It's a little bit long, but it has nice pictures of old, you know, IBM mainframes, and there's a sort of a narrative about how, you know, we're wasting all this money on typing into key, you know, punching key cards, and the technology is basically to simulate what they're trying to do is simulate a retina that's looking at these characters, and you know, just sort of they go through some of the techniques, and there's it's fun to watch, and so I would recommend it. It's very 60s, but in various ways that will be evident, I think, but nevertheless it's worth watching. If you are not entirely sure you can watch it at double speed.
Well, does that improve its accuracy?
Well, it definitely makes it feel like less of a commitment. 18 minutes is a lot.
I don't know. For a bit of 60s nostalgia, I think I'll put that one into my watch list. So, Earl, we have another retro contest. Would you like to tell us about this one?
We do. This is a contest for writing games on the Amstrad CPC 464, which isn't as well known of a computer in the States among collectors, but of course the Amstrads were quite popular in Europe. So, did I mention this is the third year of this contest organized by the University of Alicante, and this year they've opened it up internationally, which is why they reached out to us and said, hey, we're going to have this contest. It's the third year. It's fun. If you're interested in Amstrad, come join in. This contest aims to award the best and more creative developers from the Amstrad retro scene, able to create the best games for the Amstrad CPC 464. The submission deadline, if you're going to try and throw something into this, is October 23rd, 2015. And the official rules are on the site. And I'm going to note, there are cash prizes. So you're not going to get rich from this, but, you know, you could win a little bit of retro money. Like I mentioned, the Amstrad, not as well known over here. It's a really interesting looking computer, though, a Z80-based machine. Its form factor reminds me a bit of the ZX Spectrum 128 Plus 2 or the Plus 2A, or I think even the Plus 3. It's kind of one of those rectangular slabs with the integrated cassette deck. And it's got a few colored keys to spice things up. So, pretty neat. Anyway, Jose wrote in to let us know about that. So, gracias por la información, Jose, y saludos cordiales.
So, that's an interesting link to that one there. So, as you said, I don't think we'll end up becoming rich developers out of it, but it certainly will enrich the community with all those lovely games coming out. Jack, new open-ended programming game. I think you'll have to tell me more.
Yes, this is something that popped up. Something that popped up lately. There's a game called TIS 100. TIS stands for Tessellated Intelligence System. This game emulates a fictitious retro computer, and the gameplay revolves around using assembly language to solve problems and discover the secrets of the machine. Looks very cool. It looks like it looks like you're looking at a strange sort of monitor view of some kind of machine where you can sort of like, there are parts you can enter programs and you can sort of see some sort of diagnostic output and things. And it even has a nice diagnostic mode that shows at some point with a nice red, it's all like in a black background, a lot of text and just some boxes. And there's a nice red box that comes up that's very reminiscent of the Amiga Guru Meditation Error at some point. I haven't played the game yet, but it seems very cool. It also comes with a manual that looks like it's a PDF, a scanned PDF of an old manual from something from the 80s that describes what the assembly language looks like and how it works and stuff. And I think it's just a very interesting idea to make something, make a game around something that is so obtuse for most of the kind of gamer community. Like, you know, there's so many people who are playing games and using computers all the time who don't have any idea how these things really work on a low level. And this computer thing, if it exposes some people to how some of this stuff could, in theory, work. People who otherwise would never, ever touch any kind of assembly programming. So, looks pretty fun. I have not bought this or played this or anything, but I probably will because it looks pretty sweet.
Yeah, I watched the little demo video just now, and it looks quite interesting. One of the things I wonder, though, is So at the very end of the bullet points, it says, uncover the mysteries of the TIS 100. Who created it and for what purpose? And I was thinking, as I was watching this video, you know, that's neat, but why did they come up with an entirely new machine, you know, when they could have just done all this based on an existing one? Maybe that is the secret, though. Maybe we can figure out who created it and for what purpose.
I'm assuming the game works at multiple levels. So on the one level, you have kind of like programming challenges. But on the other level, there's something there's something that you uncover as you're doing the programming challenges that is beyond just the architecture of the machine, I presume. I don't know. But like I said, I'll probably buy this and play it and see what I can find out.
Yeah, definitely looks interesting. But can you pilot an Apollo lunar mission? Okay, now I've been to this website in the past. It is also quite a retro-looking website, so you have been warned. But ever wondered about the computers inside those lunar missions? They're not as exciting as all the movies make out to be. We're definitely not doing moving the mouse over to the icon of the moon and double-clicking to make it the destination or anything like that. But if you have a look at the basically verb response system that they're using, the interface and the display, and that in itself shows me why it took so long to actually travel to the moon, because this is not something that you're going to pick up quickly. So this definitely shows that there was a lot of training, a lot of understanding of the systems, and I am so glad that I don't have to use something like this to drive the car. So there's a YouTube video at the beginning sort of to show the Apollo guidance computer emulation, and it's a great read. It really shows how the technology of the time was being used for, you know, quite a difficult task for what was needed to be done. And when you consider the hardware and software that they were using, it's very impressive. But again, I'm glad I don't have to actually control anything using this type of computer interface.
Do we know if pieces of the actual machine, or even the actual machine, is still assembled somewhere?
No, I'm not quite sure if there's actually any working examples. I know they've got a couple of the return capsules on display at various places, but I don't know if any of them are, I wouldn't say operational, but at least where you could actually get in and have a look. It would be interesting, but
there is at least a picture on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I just thought that with the next anniversary of the moon landing coming up on, was it the 20th of July? So, yeah, get in now and see if you too could do your lunar mission.
Cool.
Okay, so, Paul, we have a new book by Evan Koblenz. You want to tell us a little bit more about it?
Oh yeah, well, just a brief mention of it. So Evan Koblenz, who is, I don't know what his position title is, but he's kind of like head of MARCH, the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists Group. So they have this museum at the InfoAge Center, and they're also the hosts of the VCF East. But anyway, so that sort of situates who he is. He's come in, he's been on the podcast. I think he was actually on like the first one or one of some of the very early RCRs as well. But so he's put together a book. It's called From the Abacus to the Smartphone, The Evolution of Mobile and Portable Computers. And it's it sort of distills probably, I think he said it took about 10 years to put this together. And it's, you know, not nonstop for 10 years, but it's, you know, he's been sort of assembling information about basically mobile and portable computing starting back, you know, well, starting actually with the Abacus, as the title suggests, but, you know, talking about these computers that were moved around in trucks and things like that. And it's pretty interesting. He's selling right now an electronic, like a PDF for $8. So, I mean, you know, it costs very little for this. I've skimmed it. I haven't had a chance to read it carefully, but I've looked through it, and it looks like, you know, there's plenty of stuff in there. He's because it's electronic, he's actually adding some pictures and correcting some typos, and version 1.1 is due out to those who get the 1.0 PDF soon, and there will be a print book at some point soon as well. But so it's worth, you know, it's always neat to see these things come out, and so take a look, and you know, I would recommend $8 for this.
No, I recommend it as well. I've only, same as you, just flipped through the book so far, so I've got to find some time to sit down and read it. So it might just have to wait till my reading list for when I'm flying over to Kansas Fest. So I'll get a collection of things for that. But definitely looks like an excellent book, and I highly recommend it as well. And just for something a little amusing, just recently has been posted a YouTube video of installing Windows 1.01. So if you want to watch the whole, I think it's about, again, it's one of these 18-minute long videos. But just to show you how much fun it is, the actual running of Windows doesn't actually start until 12 minutes and 30 seconds into the video. Up till then, it's basically putting in floppy disks and watching it slowly install on a dual floppy drive system. But Windows 1.1, I've got one of those original Microsoft boxes with that, the manuals and discs in it. And I've always been meaning to do a video of it running. But here's one of not only running, but being installed. So show this to your kids if they're tired of having to wait for their app to download from Google Play or the Apple App Store, and that just 5 seconds, 10 seconds of waiting for it to download and install is just too much for them. Show them this and just remind them how much fun it was back in our day. Okay, and now here's a message from our sponsor.
Taking your business on the road can be a cumbersome task, and productivity can easily fall off. Presenting the IBM PC Convertible, a powerful personal computer that easily converts to a full-function portable. One you can use in a train, a plane, a car, or a meeting. And be as productive on the road as you are at the office. The IBM PC Convertible. One computer for people who really need two.
Welcome back. Now, let's have a little bit of a host retro computing gift idea. I was sort of thinking about how we could blend old and new game playing. So here's a gamepad adapter so that you can plug it into your Commodore 64 or other similar age machines. So it's called the 64 JPX. So it's for the Commodore, Amiga, and Atari compatible systems, and basically turns your gamepad into a joypad. So multiple options here, so that you can basically choose the one to suit the target machine and your gamepad that you're using, and they're all quite reasonably priced. A little bit of a bare-bones unit, but you could easily slip it into a cover or a case of some variety. So if you're looking to replace your aging joystick and you've got some video game pads around, this might be the thing to help you bring your two gaming experiences together. So are any of you guys interested in hooking up your gamepads to your Commodore or your Amiga or your Atari?
I don't know, it looks kind of interesting, and I think in some sense just the fact that you might be able to find a gamepad, especially if you can connect any newer gamepads to it, you might be able to find newer gamepads that might be in better shape than old controllers from 30 plus years ago might be.
Okay, so now let's see what's out there on the wonderful world of eBay. So, Earl, Atari 1200 XL, tell me more.
I think the 1200 XL is an interesting-looking computer. I've always kind of liked it, even though I guess it had that specter of not complete Atari 800 compatibility. You guys correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's totally right.
I think this is a really nice setup on eBay. And $50 seems like a reasonable price. It's a 1200 XL. It's got the 1010 program recorder. It's got quite a few games. It's got some joysticks. And everything looks like it's in really nice shape. Also, the person listing the auction says that it works great. And I always like to hear that, because when you bid on these that say condition unknown, it's like, well, you're probably just buying a broken computer. So I like this. $50. Look good to me.
Looks very good to me. Looks like the computer itself is in great shape and
excellent range of peripherals and software with it.
One of the things that seems hard harder to find. I've been kind of paying a little bit of attention to Atari stuff, and almost none of these seem to come with disk drives. This one comes with a disk, but no disk drive.
Right.
It's very easy to find them with cassette drives, but the disk drives are a little harder to come by.
Yep, that does seem to be the case. You don't see that many disk drives for sale, but quite a lot of cassette drives. In fact, I noticed when I was poking around today, a whole lot of people trying to sell the original cassette drive, the 410, for like $90. It's like, wow, that's just crazy. I don't think it even cost that new back in the day. And totally not worth it because, you know, it's like new in box. Well, that just means the belts are totally dried up and not working anyway, for sure. Like, but it doesn't really, I don't know. Pretty weird that people would try and get that kind of money for a tape drive.
Yeah, some things just don't survive as new in box. Okay, Jack, I see you have an interesting watch. Is it one of these new smartwatches?
It's not one of these new smartwatches. I would say it's one of these old smartwatches. No one can have missed the Apple Watch that's come out in the past few months. But they're not the first ones on the scene with smartwatches, nor are they the ones who were the most expensive out of the starting gate. So HP released this thing called the HP-01. It's a calculator watch. It must be the original calculator watch. I'm not sure actually when this was released. It must have been the mid-70s, I'm going to guess. This was available in various colors, including gold, at different prices. And it's like a calculator watch you may have seen in the 80s and later, but it actually has a lit-up LED display. And the buttons are all kind of recessed, so you have to use a special stylus to actually poke the buttons. So unlike the other calculator watches that I've seen that I've had when I was a kid, which had little rubber buttons that stuck up, these are all recessed. You have to press them. Apparently, this thing ran on three batteries, two batteries for the display and one battery for the processor doing the work. And it had some interesting features for the time. And looks like the one that's being shown looks like it still works. It's lit up and showing something. And it's selling for, I'm seeing here, 649 euros, which seems like a lot, but actually the original price back in the day was about the same. So in today's dollars, like, that would have been thousands of dollars, what it would have cost then compared to now. So like the starting price for this was actually probably a good 6 or 8 times higher than the starting price for an Apple Watch is today. So, looks pretty sweet. I'm not going to buy it, but it's an interesting looking piece of technology, for sure.
This is a thing of beauty.
It is a thing of retro beauty, but I think I will be not buying it, just like I'm not buying the Apple Watch. But it definitely is a thing of retro beauty.
Almost exactly the same, the not buying of this and the not buying of the Apple Watch, in fact.
All the things we cannot buy.
Okay, so I thought what I'd do for my eBay auctions this time is just choose three of the personal organizers that I've used in the past. So they were basically what I considered to be the representative of the type of the time. So in 88, 89, I was using a Sharp OZ-8000. I think it was called the Wizard in the US. So that was a clamshell-styled personal assistant organizer. It ran on three button batteries, CR2032s, two main and one memory one, so that you could actually be changing the batteries while you're actually keeping everything installed. But it was quite an interesting machine at the time. And had an expansion slot that you could put in cards, very similar to the PCMCIA cards, totally different architecture. And it had a touchscreen overlay so that you could actually just select what was underneath.
Ooh.
Yeah. I've still got that one. It still works. I was using that for quite a while. I liked that one because it had a very large LCD display for the day. The next one, which this is the one that I moved to after the Sharp, and that was the Palm Pilot. So I kept the Sharp for quite a while. If anyone ever sees mine, they'll actually see that it's amazing that it actually survived. There's scratches and a few gouges in there. It certainly has travelled quite far, quite extensively, and survived quite well. But the next one, I think, was really the organizer that changed the whole concept of a personal organizer. That was the Palm Pilot. So it came with a stylus. You used the graffiti language to draw the characters on the screen. I used this one for a number of years, so it was good to see someone with a good looking clean set for the Palm Pilot, and not a bad price either. But the one that I really liked the most before I went and to the iPhone and the Android phone world was my Sony Clea NX70. Now, this again was a clamshell-style organizer with a half VGA screen, but what was special about it is that it had a rotating screen, so you could actually have it both as a organizer with a keypad. You can see the keypad there on the screen when you go into the link. But you could actually rotate the screen and close it and just have it as a full screen PDA, again running the Palm OS. And it had expansion slots. You could have put a Wi-Fi card in. I actually put in a 4 GB CF card with a hacked version of the FAT16 file system, so they could actually use that. And again, I used that one right up until the iPhone 3GS came out. So again, I got some long mileage out of that. So if you're into organizers, and organizers seem to me run on a different time scale to the retro computers, the Clea, even though it was from the early 2000s, has a little bit of a retro feel about it. But the Palm Pilot and the Sharp, they've definitely got some real retro cred. But I just thought I'd just use eBay just to show some of the other parts of my retro collection. This is actually the stuff that I've used and held on to.
Yeah, I was a pretty diehard Palm user for quite a while there. I think I had several of them. I think I started with a 3XE, and the auction listing here was a 3, so the same sort of type. I had actually a sort of hard metal box holster for it that I would carry it around in, you know, so it was sort of protected from being banged up with, you know, by the world. But boy, that thing was quite heavy. But I traveled around Europe with it, using it as, like, you know, take notes on it and things like that. And yeah, I really liked it. I still have, and I sort of went through a bunch of these. I think I remember that the Clea has I think it had a taller screen. I think that, you know, there was something about the resolution that you know, you always had to sort of, like, tell the software whether it was using a Clea or not. But I still have it's a Trio smartphone that sits on my shelf, and once a year or so it you know, it beeps a reminder to something that I'd forgotten to turn the alarm off on. So it's, you know, it's still working. It doesn't connect to the network anymore, but I still have a functioning Palm device.
Yeah, cool. I definitely love going through eBay to have a little bit of a trip down memory lane at times. It's a little bit easier to have a look at devices than it is to actually drag them out. But no, if anyone's interested in organizers, in my opinion, these are sort of like three great representatives of the different stages of organizers before, as I said, before the iPhone and the Android phones came out. Yeah. So, Paul, what have you found on eBay?
So one of the things I found was a Sperry UNIVAC 8-inch drive. It's a 8406 floppy drive, 8-inch floppy drive, dual thing. I find it interesting primarily just because it says UNIVAC on it. I think it would be kind of cool to have something in one's possessions that says UNIVAC. This particular thing, I don't know if it's being listed for $500. I don't know if I would buy it just because I feel a little bit guilty about having a thing that, you know, could actually possibly connect for somebody else to a machine that they have, rather than just having this thing as a display unit. Although it's possible that these drives would work with other things that need 8-inch drives. I don't know. But anyway, this particular drive unit is designed as a peripheral to an intelligent terminal that, you know, that UNIVAC made in order to connect up to the mainframes. So it's not, you know, it looks like something for a desk machine, and it is in fact something for a desk machine, but it has this UNIVAC logo on it, so it's kind of neat. That's cool. The other thing that I found, so this one is, I really hovered over the buy it button on this for a long time, and then I decided, nah, I'm not going to have time to play with this. But so it's an Oki Semiconductor CMOS 8-bit microcomputer kit thing. So what it is basically is a single board computer, and it's essentially for the purpose of kind of like playing around with the, well, it's like the Intel 8049, I think, which I think is a development of the 8048, and this is the Oki version of that. So basically it's a, you know, they marketed it as basically like a full microcomputer on a chip, you know, so it has memory and ways to access the outside world. This particular kit was something that they sent out, I guess, to people who requested it, you know, who wanted to get to figure out sort of like how you can use this chip. And it's really quite a cool, you know, it's a box full of stuff. It has a printed circuit board. It has and on it there's an interface cable that lets you plug it into the processor slot of something that could accept this if you wanted to. It has an EEPROM or EEPROM something that you can program, you know, so you can run programs on it. It has the manuals. It has a couple, you know, it has a spec sheet, preliminary spec sheet from 1982, and a little, you know, like a cover letter, and actually also a cross assembler for CPM. Apparently, it looks like it's on an 8-inch disk, so maybe that 8-inch drive could be used to read this. But anyway, it's a neat thing to look at. I would suggest at least looking at this. I did a little bit of research and decided that I don't want to learn a whole new set of assembly instructions in order to use this thing, but it's a cool thing. It's listed right now at a buy it now of $25, so it's not an expensive thing to play around with if you might find that interesting.
Now, that definitely looks quite an interesting one there, and a wonderful price. Yeah, same thing, I'm just having to keep my hand away from the buy it now. Well, that was an interesting haul of eBay treasures this time round. So, time to wrap things up. Earl, what have you got just to close us out?
Just the fourth thing I'm going to work on the Commodore 128 that I mentioned earlier for the Retro Challenge. If people want to keep up on it, it's going to be at 4th128.blogspot.com. And I guess we could have that in the notes.
Oh, that's something I'll definitely be interested in following. Okay, Jack, what have you got to close us out?
I don't have too much of anything right now. I think I'm mostly looking forward to trying to get some work done on some other projects that are not really super retro, like some games that I've got in store that I'm working on. Although any game that I work on is invariably retro tinged because I can't help but sort of reach back into the distant past on things. But I don't have anything to really say about it yet. So there we go.
Paul, and have you got anything to close us out this time around?
Well, no, you know, sort of specific projects. I'm still in trying to organize everything that I already have accumulated. So we'll see.
Well, nothing much happening at my end of the world in the retro side of things, but just getting all of my travel plans and whatnot organized to meet you over at K-Fest. So we'll see how things go there. Well, that's it for this show. You can find show notes for all of the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintagecomputer.com, in the Vintage Computer Forum. You can follow us on...
Hello? Anybody? Hello? Hey, Paul.
Hello.
Michael? No.
Nope. Oh, now I've got another incoming call.
What's happening?
Skype's having another bad hair day.
Okay, this shows me that.
Okay.
It must be everybody calling each other for Father's Day.
That's because I have two current calls.
Here, I'm going to hang up on Jack. Okay, is Jack there? No, he's trying.
Hello?
Okay, who... Can anyone hear me?
Hello? I'm here.
So, does Michael know what's happening? I mean, has he finished this up on his own by now?
We don't know. No responses from Michael.
Retro compute.
Retro compute.